Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. Call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. I'd like to go over our agenda with everyone here so you will know what is or isn't going to be happening today. Dropping down to the work sessions, I'm going to first open up a work session on Senate Bill 77. The purpose of opening it up is to carry this bill over till tomorrow. The reason for that is that we had it scheduled for tomorrow based on Monday, but we had to carry it from today to get it to be able to be carried over to Wednesday. So that closed the public work session. The next two work sessions, Senate Bill 495 and Senate Bill 365, those two are going to be carried over until next Tuesday. We have amendments that are needed for both of those bills, and that means we have to get them routed back through legislative, fiscal, and revenue to allow them to be ready. So if you're here on 495 or 635, they will be carried over. In other words, they will be reposted for next week, which would be the, I guess it would be like the 9th.
No.
The 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th would be the 5th. Okay. We're rushing through the session. All right. With that, then we're going to start off with our public hearings. At this point, the chair plans to go from the top of the order to the bottom. So we're opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 39.
Thank you, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. Senate Bill 39 requires the Department of Justice to establish a restitution collection pilot program to make grants sufficient to enable district attorney's offices to hire and employ a restitution clerk who will investigate evidence of damages suffered by crime victims and the ability of defendants to pay restitution as ordered by the court. The Department of Justice will also employ collection agents who will work in the field to make collection efforts on outstanding debts owed by defendants.
All right, thank you. We have, I believe, five individuals who wanted to testify today. I'm going to go ahead and call up the first three, Bob Robson, Shannon Savelle, and Brad Berry. Whoever would like to lead us off. Okay, Shannon, your children.
Good morning, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. My name is Shannon Savelle. I'm the legislative director at the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here to speak on Senate Bill 39 today. Providing restitution to victims should be an integral part of our criminal justice system. Article 1, Section 42 of the Oregon Constitution guarantees victims the right to prompt restitution. And this is not merely a symbolic gesture. It's not merely about recognizing that a victim has experienced loss or providing them a voice in a criminal justice proceeding. Providing restitution is a very real part of providing victims the financial assistance they need in order to address the impact a crime has had and may continue to have on their lives. Senate Bill 39 is the Oregon Department of Justice's proposal for taking the first steps toward creating a first-class restitution system in the state of Oregon. As I said, it's a pilot program, and what it aims to do is two things: to guarantee that we have accurate restitution orders that accurately reflect a victim's loss signed by a judge, and that on the other end, that we are promptly collecting on those restitution orders. What Senate Bill 39 proposes to do is to create pilot programs in three counties or collections of counties, and in each of those counties we would put a restitution agent in the court itself, and that person would be responsible for investigating the defendant's ability to pay on restitution, if in fact a payment plan is ordered, but more importantly to fully and completely investigate the victim's loss so that that restitution order completely reflects the impact the crime has had on the victim's life. After that, the other part of the pilot program would be to have collection agents that work for the Department of Justice working in those counties or jurisdictions to work with the courts, community corrections, and the restitution agent to make sure that the defendant is paying on the restitution order, and if they aren't, that they are reporting to parole and probation in the courts, and we know why. We studied several programs throughout the United States, primarily Vermont and Colorado, In Colorado, there are approximately 67 FTE on the ground. They're collection agents, and they bring in about $20 million a year. And one of the most important things we found in studying that program is that having the collection agent and the collection clerk actually in the community working with the defendant and working with the court was a more progressive and positive way of actually ensuring that restitution was collected. What those collection agents do, in addition to just kind of monitoring the situation, is to work with the defendant to look at their budget, to look at whether they have a cell phone bill, whether they have a cable bill, and to look at the areas where they can cut back in one area in order to make a meaningful payment towards the restitution owed in another area. We propose to pay for this program. The five programs would cost approximately $1.8 million for the biennium. The Department of Justice proposes to pay for that program out of the criminal injuries compensation account that is funded by punitive damages. That's an account that is in the Department of Justice. It is not general fund money. And those monies that are in the account currently go towards paying our crime victims' compensation funds. We have support from the Oregon Law Center, Crime Victims United, and the National Crime Victims Law Institute to use these funds, the biennium, in order to pay for the program up front. And what we propose is that when the money does come in from the restitution, that the current system provides that 50 cents goes to the victim and 50 cents comes to the CFAA account. A piece of the 50 cents that comes to the CFAA account would go back to repay the Crime Victims Injury Compensation Fund. Now, this does not have a fiscal impact, I believe, and I'm not sure if you have the fiscal impact statement in front of you. But the reason it does not is that over the biennium, we anticipate that we will more than just simply pay back the $1.8 million. We will actually bring money into the general fund. I just lastly like to note that currently in the Department of Justice, we have two collections agents who work in our criminal injuries compensation area. And those two agents collectively bring in $2.4 million biennium. So with five collection agents, we anticipate that we will not only be able to cover the $1.8 million that we're borrowing from our fund, but also eventually bring in additional monies to not just the restitution, but also to the CFAA and general fund. I'd just like to lastly wrap up with a couple of facts, and that is that currently, as of February 8th, 2010, $369,349,000 was owed in restitution in the state of Oregon. Yes, $369,349,000. And in 2010, $50.8 million was ordered and $6.5 million was collected. That was 12.9%. And 2009, $49.3 million was ordered and $11.1 million was collected. On a last note, we have spoken to OJD, and this would be a program that would work in conjunction with them. We would not be duplicating efforts, but we do believe that this pilot program, which would sunset in 2 years, and we would have to come back and tell you what we've done and if we've actually brought in the revenue both to victims and the CFAA that we expect. We would have to come back to you, I'm sorry, but ultimately that we expect that this will actually bring in money in restitution that is not currently collected. Thank you.
Thanks. Who'd like to go next?
I guess if I can point at Shannon, Bob can point at me. My name is Brad Berry. For the record, I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney, and I chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. Senator Przanski and members of the committee, I'd like to give you I should point out initially, the Oregon District Attorneys Association supports this bill, greatly supports this bill, and what I'd like to do is explain a little bit about victims from the street level, from in the trenches level. One thing that we've done in our office that is very similar to the program which is suggested here, and to explain to you some of the results we've seen. First, restitution for victims is one of those things that is as tangible as anything in the criminal process that they have. They have many rights in the criminal justice system. They come before the court and they listen to individuals get sentenced. They're contacted about proposals on how to resolve cases, all the rights that we've discussed over the years that the victims have. But oftentimes, restitution is ordered and in for weeks, months, years, maybe the entire time that a person is on probation, a victim sees very little, if any, money come back to them. And these are direct losses. It's interesting that oftentimes the biggest cases that we see are those cases that involve hundreds of thousands of dollars in losses. That's often elder fraud. It can be embezzlement cases. It can be people with gambling addictions who commit theft in various ways. But oftentimes the restitution which seems to go unpaid can be small amounts which have a tremendous impact on a particular victim. I think of one case where we had a woman in Amity who had a car stolen. The car was worth something like $500 to $1,000, but that was the only transportation she had from her small community to get to any and all of the resources available to her in the county. And her loss of $500 to $1,000, which much greater to her than most large employers we might see, which would suffer a loss of $50,000 in an embezzlement case. One of the interesting things about restitution could be how difficult it can be for individuals to determine what their actual loss is. Just evaluating a car that has been stolen is different than, for example, cases where individuals may have suffered a loss of thefts over a period of time. Someone who has stolen your credit card, for example, or your debit card, who had at some point authorization to use it, and now I'm talking, for example, in elder fraud cases, where you give permission for somebody to go out and make purchases for you, and then suddenly we find that a bank account that had $40,000 or $50,000 in it has been depleted. And it takes time and it's difficult for individuals to determine how much of that is loss and how much of that is authorized. In our office, we found through the county that, let me start with what most district attorneys do. I think that's the easiest way. Most district attorneys work hard through their victim assistance programs to determine what the restitution loss is. We work hard to see that the court is given sufficient information and backup evidence in order to order the complete restitution amount to be repaid by a particular defendant. And we see that the judgment appropriately reflects the restitution amount. Then most district attorney's office go on to their next case. And we expect that a probation office, corrections, community corrections, will take on the task for individuals to see that they pay. Individuals placed on probation often have many types of problems. They can have addiction issues, gambling, drugs, for example. They can have domestic violence treatment that they're required to do. And it's not uncommon that probation officers tend to rely first on seeing that treatment issues are addressed and second, that restitution is paid. I'm not suggesting that that's right or wrong. I'm suggesting it is a fact. Oftentimes, individuals with restitution obligations will pay monies towards these other obligations first, and then finally work towards restitution. But it's not uncommon that they come off of probation still owing restitution. About 3 years ago, our county partnered with community corrections, with the courts, and we applied for a VOCA grant to pay for a restitution specialist. These are the exact types of individuals that this bill is designed to put out there for pilot programs. We're a medium-sized county. Our needs are different than many other counties, so it's difficult to say whether our process would work elsewhere, but I can tell you that we got the grant funding, and we created a program where I have a restitution specialist who, first, is obligated to aid victims in determining what their restitution loss is, and then, secondly, once convictions have been obtained and restitution orders are made, they partner with, and as I have said, reach across the street to the community corrections to aid in collection of restitution for individuals who owe it. We have a much broader program relating to overall how we're dealing with restitution issues, but I will tell you that our collection rates for those cases which we have brought into the restitution project are anywhere from 2 to 4 times the collection rates in any particular month or period of time over those who go the more normal track. And it's because we're able to put attention to those particular cases. Just manpower can tell you that we can't deal with every case that has restitution. And so cases that have been brought into the restitution project, we take an equal number of randomly selected cases with restitution orders, otherwise on the docket, otherwise where there are orders outstanding, and we compare monthly what our collection rates are, and routinely they're better. The point being that victims are benefiting from the attention that can be put to restitution and the attention that can be brought to work with defendants, to work with community corrections, and to work with the courts to see that individuals pay what they're obligated to pay. Simple things such as informing defendants of the cost of a latte 5 times a week, what they can save, and that money can go towards restitution. I had a woman on the witness stand about a month and a half ago who was paying $150 a month for cable service and couldn't understand why the judge was so upset with her because she wasn't making any payments towards restitution. It's our ability to garner that information, put it before the court if necessary, and more importantly, to work with and educate defendants that there are ways to get this restitution paid to the benefit of victims. That's what this Senate bill would do, and I urge you to support it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Bob.
Good morning, Senator, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Bob Robison. I live in Northeast Portland. I'm proud to be represented by Senator Dingfelder. So who am I and why do I care about this bill? I spent the last 6 years of my career working as the Victim Services Manager for Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. It's the parole and probation agency in Multnomah County. About a third of the time in that job, I was spending my time helping collect restitution on behalf of crime victims and survivors. I was also a part of the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force. I also helped form, with some of my frontline colleagues, the Oregon Restitution Network. We were people from community corrections, the courts, the Judicial Department, Department of Justice. Again, people on the front line who were meeting on a regular basis, sharing information about best practices and how to improve our ability to collect restitution. Unfortunately, the position I had with Multnomah County was cut because of budget cuts. That's the bad news. The good news is it was the same time when I was able to start collecting my pension, so I was able to perhaps spend some time more casually like this trying to improve the system. In many Oregon counties, the restitution system is not working as well as it should. I advocated on behalf of many crime victims who were deeply disappointed that they weren't getting the restitution that the court had ordered. They knew that it was their right, and it just wasn't happening, and they just couldn't understand why that was the case. Of course, there are many challenges in getting people who are convicted to pay for the cost of their crime. Some have not accepted responsibility for what they've done. They still think and behave as criminals. Holding those people accountable to pay their restitution, I believe strongly, is part of their rehabilitation. We can and should do a better job at that. But we must also recognize that many people convicted of crimes want to right the wrongs they've caused, but face huge barriers to finding work. Of course, those barriers include a lack of education and job skills, addictions, mental health problems, and a lousy job market. And, of course, a felony conviction never helps one's career. excuse me. Why I think the pilot project is a good idea. As was stated, it will improve court judgments, both in the accuracy of the financial loss as well as the payment schedules that are clear, creative, and realistic. Many victims are disappointed because they know their constitutional right to receive prompt restitution, yet they do not get what they believe are prompt or adequate payments. A court order with a realistic payment schedule should clarify to the victim and to the offender how the debt will be paid. It will clearly also improve collections. Someone who can track the payments and help parole and probation officers get the debt paid will be very important. In many cases, this will avoid the additional 15% cost of referring the debt to the Department of Revenue when payments are in arrears. Thank you. Parole and probation officers are busy trying to prevent future crimes and need the help of collection specialists. Collection specialists know how to do things that POs don't know how to do, for example, garnish wages and bank accounts and checking on other assets. And I think the third point why I think it's a really good idea is that if it's successful, and I think it will be, it can be replicated around the state. It'll be pretty easy to evaluate by simply tracking the improved collection rates in those counties that are participating. One thing I would like to point out is that there are several Oregon counties that have created restitution courts, which I believe are being particularly effective and creative. And if you decide to look more into this issue, you might want to see what those counties are doing. I also gave you in written testimony some examples of some cases that I had worked on where I think a program like this might have been helpful. And I don't know if you'd like me to take the time to do those or just read them. Or
If it's written testimony, if we have it, we'll be able to go through it on our own. But I appreciate you, one, being here, two, putting all this together to give us real-life examples from someone that's actually on the front line of trying to collect restitution. You have anything else, Bob, that you'd like to cover?
I think it's a real good idea. I hope you'll consider it.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Prusansky. First, for the Department of Justice, I wonder if you could provide for us the age of the accounts receivable, the relative age. You said $359 million, but I imagine some of those are quite old. And the second thing, which could give us the potential roll-up cost if this program were to be carried forward to the 13-15 biennium, what the roll-up cost to the Department of Justice would be for that. Second question, if I may, for the Department of DA. If a restitution specialist were hired for each county in the state, I'm sure that all counties don't have courts. I understand that, but I mean, a rough estimate, assuming that they would cost a total compensation about $80,000 a year, which is about just a little over what the average compensation for a public employee is, you'd be looking at about $5.7 million of cost to provide those people out into the country. And I was wondering if this bill contemplates tying the compensation to those restitution specialists to their successful collections. I mean, are we just going to go out there and hire a bunch of people and have them assume that they're going to do a good job, or are we going to tie their compensation to their success?
Chair Zonsky, members of the committee, as Senator Witt said, let me see. I'll just kind of try to go through those one by one. The age of the accounts, I did not collect this data here. Someone did it for me, but my understanding is that went back about 20 years. So these are not just new accounts. This goes back for a considerable period of time. The second one is that the roll-up costs. Let me see if I understand exactly what you're asking. We expect it would be 1.8 for the current biennium, so for 11 to 13. If we come back to you in 2013 and the legislature, we have data and we can prove that we have brought in more money to both victims and to the CFAA, and the legislature chose to extend this or expand it, I believe that it would cost less. It would cost somewhat less, but I think 1.8 is essentially kind of the standard for how much it would cost on a biennium basis to continue this pilot program. Ultimately, if we are successful, I think what we'd hope is that it might be at some point expanded to the rest of the state. The reason it's proposed as a pilot is because we recognize that we are in a difficult financial situation, and this is a size project that we think will do good, will actually provide real data, and that we can actually self-fund. So I hope, and then if you'd like me just to address the last piece.
If I could follow up just a little bit. What I was looking for is the roll-up cost of the personal services. If it was continued into the next biennium, that would be fairly simple for you to compute. The approximate $360 million, and you said those accounts go back. Mm-hmm. The likelihood of being able to collect an account 20 years in arrears is pretty slim. So what I was trying to get at is how much of that $360 million pot that you're looking at is actually high probability that you could collect. As you know, the accounts receivable are actually depreciable. And in the private sector, as they get older, you're actually allowed to depreciate those from your balance sheet because they're not collectible. Yeah, of course, if you do collect them, you have to recapture that income. But I mean, to say that there's $360 million pot out there, how much of it really is collectible? I'd like to, if you could give us some idea of that, and I don't expect you to have that on the top of your head.
Chair Prusansky, Senator Witzett, you're correct, of course, that I don't have it off the top of my head. I can tell you that when we looked at this program and looked at what it would cost and what we thought, what funds we thought it would generate, we aren't looking at this being a windfall. We don't expect we're going to get $369 million in the next biennium. But what we do expect is that with our current track record of collection, which is approximately $1.2 million per collection agent per biennium, that five collection agents we expect will bring in a minimum of $5 million. And while that's barely a drop in the bucket with $369 million outstanding, what it is nearly almost double what was collected in 2010 for restitution victims. So it doesn't start with attacking the $369 million all at once, but it will definitely, if we can even double what we brought in last year, that's a not insignificant amount for victims, and that's what we're trying to do, is to build this program. But I will see if I can get you any additional numbers.
All right. Other questions, Senator Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Shannon, I wanted to ask if you have counties in mind. We've heard in the testimony today that there have been or are programs in at least some of the counties. Would you go to those counties where there are existing programs or to additional counties?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Bonamici, we do not have counties in mind, per se. When we designed this, we looked at what was currently happening in Oregon, and Clackamas County currently has a restitution court, and you heard DA Bradbury comment on Yamhills, and my understanding is that Yamhills will shortly be running out of funding. So what we did is we designed a program, and I think you have the -4s in front of you. And what we tried to do was design it with enough flexibility. And the intention is this, that we will put out grant applications, and the various counties that are interested or groups of counties will apply to the program. And we wanted to make sure that the way the pilot was written was flexible enough to allow that if there's a county that has a current program that has a proven track record of success and they are losing funding, that we would be able to supplement or provide one of the grants to them so that we aren't forcing them to reinvent their entire program and they can continue with their good works. But honestly, we do not have anybody in mind at this point. We're hoping for, I would say, 4 counties and maybe 1 collection of counties to get maximum exposure.
All right. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe the district attorney had the opportunity to answer my second question.
Chair Pozanski, Senator Whitsitt, if I can address just a couple of the issues. I tried to jot down some notes what you were asking. First, cost of the counties. My restitution specialist, who I mentioned was grant-funded through a VOCA grant, the cost of her is not $80,000 a year, so I think it probably more between $45,000 to $60,000, depending on the type of individual who was hired, which is, I didn't look to see what my cost was. It's about that. The issue, though, I think an interesting issue that you mentioned was whether or not to, in fact, kind of pay on a commission. The more you collect or you collect to your pay, that provides a couple of unique issues when looking at the criminal justice system and this program as a whole. First, our program is a team project, which relies on the probation department, the courts, as well as our office to work as a team to get the most restitution collected that we can. But secondly, I would be concerned that if I created, let me back up. First, it's my job to ensure that my employee is doing their job, working hard and collecting, and I do that. But now getting back to your question, if in fact we have an individual who in part their pay is tied to what they collect, I would be concerned that they would go after low-hanging fruit, and they would go after individuals who are more likely to pay on larger debts than individuals who pay on perhaps lower debt, but where the loss to a victim proportionately or by comparison is much greater. And I would be worried that it could potentially create a disincentive for what might be the better approach at the collection of restitution.
All right, Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a question for Bob, and thanks for being here, Bob. It's great that you're spending your retirement at the Oregon legislature. But we appreciate it and appreciate your service. Question about, in your testimony, you said that you spent about one-third of your time helping crime victims. Were there other folks at Multnomah County doing restitution work, number one? Number two is, what was the, I'm curious for Multnomah County, which obviously is the largest county in the state, what our recovery rate was for restitution services, and if you think a program like this would help in Multnomah County?
By all means, a program like this would help in Multnomah County. One of the challenges we faced was whenever there, we also established a position of a collections specialist in the court through a VOCA grant. When the VOCA grant was expired, the county picked up those funds. We could have used at least another FTE. One of the challenges we faced with other pilot programs, frankly, was that people thought Multnomah County is so big that one FTE is not going to make much difference. I was very frustrated with that because I think another FTE would make a difference. So I hope Multnomah County will compete for this and be successful. So yeah, more help would be there. Your other question was?
Well, what percentage of recovery? We had heard that it was fairly low statewide. I was curious about what, if you knew what the percentage recovery was.
I've been away from that job for a couple of years now. I recall about 30%. And I recall there being some data nationally that it's about the recovery rate. But I am convinced you can improve that. One of the big challenges we faced in Multnomah County was people who are low risk to recidivate. Our best practices in community corrections tell us very clearly that you want to focus your resources, your limited resources, on those who are more likely to recidivate. So parole officers who are actively supervising their caseload have pretty small, relatively caseloads. What we do is we assign those people who are in reduced supervision, those people who are unlikely to recidivate. And those caseloads sometimes exceed 300. It's very difficult to track restitution on a caseload like that. One of the advantages of having a restitution clerk who could work in support of the POs in those caseloads is that, first of all, collection specialists are less expensive than POs. They can also have very large caseloads. They can, because the databases they use, they can track payments for a whole bunch of people and help the POs know those who are in arrears. The other thing that has sort of been suggested here that I think is important to note is that restitution is more important for some people than for others. And I know this is a sticky area, but I often had to make triage-like decisions between working on behalf of some people whose life savings had been stolen and their retirement was being affected, and a large insurance company. And I think a clerk could work in hand in glove with POs to make those kind of judgment calls.
All right. Thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you.
Bob, just to let you know, your testimony was received. It is on what's called the S drive. Since I'm chairing, I don't bring a computer down with me, but it is there, so thank you very much. All right, we have two other people who are scheduled to testify today on this bill, Arlen Byrd and Sybil Hebb.
Chair Posonsky, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, also to voice support in Senate Bill 39. From the perspective of low-income clients who are our client base, collection of restitution, the award and collection of restitution is of even greater importance than to the larger population for the simple fact that many victims with zero financial resources don't have the ability to make the repairs or address the issues that have been caused as a result of the crime. Just as an example, we have a client who was a victim of domestic violence. Her front door was beaten down and damaged significantly in the assault, and the ability to repair that and get that done quickly and efficiently and securely is important and expensive, and restitution for that sort of damage makes a huge difference in that person's life. And so I think the other key factor that we really appreciate and acknowledge in this pilot program is that the availability of the clerks on hand will help victims as well as prosecutors, and the courts, in that there will be experts who are available to ensure that the courts have all of the information that they need in order to make the award that's appropriate in that circumstance, taking into account what was the damage and the impact on the victim's life, and also what is the perpetrator's ability to pay, what are those person's resources. And so that helps prosecutors to ask for the right award, helps judges to make the right award, and helps victims to ensure that they're more likely to get paid and reimbursed. And I think I'll just briefly add one other piece, which is that the fact that these payments are coming from the offender, the person who has caused the damage, is of great importance to many victims in feeling as though the justice system has responded to the incidents and the injuries that they've suffered. So we really appreciate the establishment of this pilot project, and we have great hopes for it. Thank you.
Thank you. Arlen?
Good morning. My name is Arlen Byrd, Chair Prozanski and members of the committee. I'm here on behalf of the Partnership for Safety and Justice. As many of you know, we're an organization that represents people that have been victimized by crime, as well as people who have been convicted of crimes and the families of both. And because of this unique perspective, we take a holistic approach to how our criminal justice system needs to respond to violence. And as a result, also take a holistic approach to how restitution actually gets to crime victims. So as an organization, we've decided to take a neutral position on this proposal. I think for me personally, restitution is very important. I am a survivor of crime, and I actually am one of those people who 18 years out is still owed $75,000 in restitution. So I know that earlier they were mentioning just the large sums that are still due in the unusual cases and the lower likelihood that those amounts will be collected. I still am working personally to try and help the system hold the person who hurt my sister and I be accountable, but feel frustrated that there really is a lack of resource for us, particularly in the long term. And on that specific issue, I'm glad that y'all are looking at this particular proposal and that you're invested in restitution, or at least from what I'm hearing, helping survivors get restitution. And I would encourage you to stay there, because it's challenging for me to hear even just a suggestion that somehow, because an order was 20 years or 30 years old, that there would be somehow a diminished interest in collecting that, you know, particularly for the tremendous investment that we're willing to put into incarcerating people for 20 or 30 years, the amount of investment that we're willing to put in punishing people. I wish that we were as interested in helping survivors in the long term as well. And I really feel that restitution is one of the ways that we can provide assistance for survivors in the long run. So just one more suggestion for all of you to consider. When you're looking at large issues like restitution, I would encourage you to also be putting time and energy into job training and placement programs for people that have been convicted of crimes. As an organization, the Partnership for Safety and Justice tries to take that holistic perspective in terms of what actually creates accountability in communities. And so for me as a survivor, it's not just enough to have the restitution order. I want to know that the system is also working to help the person who has been convicted and charged with paying restitution in their ability to actually make those payments. And so I absolutely see job placement and training as part of accountability and as part of successful restitution programs. So thank you, and I welcome any questions that you may have.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Questions for either of the individuals? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question. Arwin, we have your written testimony, but it appears to be cut off at the bottom. So
oh, dear.
I'd like to finish reading it, so if you could just get it to us, I'd appreciate it.
That was me printing late last night, so yeah.
Thank you. Email it to us. If you just email it.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. Thank you for bringing that to my attention.
Thank you all very much for coming forward. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 39? Not seeing anyone. We'll close that public hearing. We're now going to open. And I see we have two bills with numerous similar people. I think we're going to have to do them separate, though, just because of the topics. So let's go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 415. Council.
Thank you, Chair Przonski, members of the committee. In Oregon, there are three levels of driving while suspended or revoked in terms of severity. Senate Bill 415 refers to the lesser of these, which is violation level driving while suspended or revoked. It proposes an increase in penalties for a certain type of incident, that being if the commission of the offense contributes to the serious injury or death of a vulnerable user of a public way. If that is so found, Senate Bill 415 would require the court to impose a particular sentence that requires the person to complete a traffic safety course, perform between 100 and 200 hours of community service, including activities related to driver improvement, traffic safety, and impose and suspend a fine of up to $12,500. The violator would be given a year to complete the conditions imposed, though an extension could be granted on a finding of good cause, and upon completion, that the suspended fine could then be waived, and if it was not completed, would be imposed. This is something police officers would affirmatively note on a citation at the time of issuance. Senate Bill 415 would also require that anyone cited in such a way make a personal appearance the first time they are meant to appear in court.
All right, thank you. First, we'll call up Jonathan Manton, Ray Thomas, and Maureen. And Maureen, I'm not going to try the last name.
Chair Przonski, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Manton. and I'm testifying today on behalf of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance in support of Senate Bill 415. And my testimony, as well as those of the other, as that of the other proponents of the bill today, will be regarding the Dash 1 amendments, which I think that Aaron just described. Is that right? I came in kind of late there. But the Dash 1 amendments are significantly different than the original bill, and so I just want to note that what we're asking the committee to adopt today is not the original Senate Bill 415, but rather the Senate Bill 415-1s. And with the Dash 1 amendment, the intent of the bill is to make a little technical fix when these vulnerable roadway user penalties are in play. Current law says that it imposes an additional penalties on careless drivers when their careless driving contributed to the serious physical injury or death of a vulnerable roadway user. And vulnerable roadway users, just as a little bit of background, are defined as highway workers, pedestrians, operators of farm tractors, skateboarders, bicyclists, roller skaters, inline skaters, and scooters. So I'll kind of hold up while you guys get caught up on the Dash 1s there. So current law requires that when an officer is issuing the citation for careless driving that contributed to the serious physical injury or death of a VRU, that they note that on the citation itself. And what they're supposed to note on the citation is that the careless driving contributed to the serious physical injury or death. And what we found is that this really is imposing a requirement on law enforcement officials that is often uncomfortable, so that they're essentially being asked to make a legal determination as to causation and as to the serious physical injury. And so all our bill with the Dash 1 would do is insert the three words "appears to have" in front of the contributed word, so that under this bill it would say the police officer should note on the citation that the serious physical injury, that the careless driving appears to have contributed to the serious physical injury rather than the careless driving contributed. So it's just an effort to give the officers that element of discretion to allow them to better enforce existing law. And I'd be happy to answer any questions and help out in any way that I can. And I note that I just spoke to the District Attorney Association representative outside, and I think that we've got those issues resolved because they were talking about the original bill rather than the Dash 1 amendment.
All right.
Ray? Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Ray Thomas. I'm a representative of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance's legislative committee. I've submitted written materials that provide a statutory analysis of how it is that police officers take their training cues from the actual statutes, which provide that when they cite a person for a violation, they are trained to make that decision to cite a person for a violation based upon what they observe at the scene or what they're told by another police officer, which is almost a first-hand knowledge requirement. The reason that we wanted to improve the bill make it more user-friendly for police officers is, of course, because it's an important contribution to our traffic laws, and we want to make it closely track the training that police officers receive. And they're very careful to stay within their comfort level in that they don't have medical training, they don't provide a medical diagnosis, and what they want to be able to do is to testify or put into a citation what appears to them from the scene of a collision. And that's why we've put the words "appears to" in connection with the contribution to the serious physical injury. And we believe that this will make the law easier to work with, and it's a law that has been recognized in other states as being a good idea, in that the states of New York and Delaware have both copied our law, and this law, the vulnerable user law, has become the law passed by those legislatures and signed into law by those governors, and they're working with this. And we just want our version of it to be the best language for the folks out in the streets and at collision scenes who are trying to work with it. Thank you for considering it.
Thank you very much. Maureen?
Good morning, Chairman Przanski, members of the committee. I'm Maureen Savigny. I'm here from Klamath Falls, Oregon. And I'm a member, one of eight, of the Oregon Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee. We are a citizens committee appointed by the governor to be advisory to the Oregon Department of Transportation on matters relating to bicycling and walking in the state of Oregon. And all of us are extremely active in bicycling and walking, but we are all passionate about safety for all roadway users, motorists, and all of the other vulnerable users that were mentioned in earlier testimony. Yesterday, our committee, known as OBPAC, because it's a mouthful to say the entire name, met, and among our other business, we did vote unanimously to support the amended Senate Bill 415-1, because we also recognize that having the vulnerable users law is great, but only if it's enforceable. And we see this as the opportunity to allow our law enforcement officials to exercise their professional judgment and be able then to bring forward their interpretation of what occurred at the scene of a collision that will actually provide the protection for vulnerable users that the law intended as it was originally written. So we believe this change in language is extremely important for safety for the Oregon roadway community. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Last two we have signed up is Brad Berry and Don Adamski. Don, I'm going to let you go first.
Chair Przanski and committee members, my name is Don Adamski. I'm a 75-year-old avid bicyclist and was hit in June of 2008 and am still under recovery. I was hit by a SUV making a dangerous left turn and failing to yield right away. Suffered 9 broken ribs, 2 of them in 3 spots, punctured lung, requiring a drain tube insertion, severed index finger, and other injuries, and spent 8 days in the OHSU trauma ward. As I said, the recovery is ongoing. And without a doubt, I support 415-1 and think that the modification will help our officers do a much better job in supporting the laws. Thank you.
Thank you. Brad?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, again, my name is Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney, and I chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. I originally signed up on this bill as opposing. Through one of your prior speakers, I was given a copy of the Dash 1 amendments, which I was unaware of. And with the Dash 1 amendments as they are, the ODAA would not oppose this bill. I quickly read through this, and so I apologize that this might seem kind of late. I didn't have a chance to mention it to John either. He mentioned to me in the hallway that there were two kind of issues of concern as they we had concerns with the strict liability portion of this, the original bill. It's not in here any longer. He mentioned there were two areas where officers were uncomfortable. One is the current requirement that the citation says that it did contribute rather than appears to contribute. I think that's taken care of here. The other is an officer's reticence to declare that we have serious physical injury of the individual who was hurt. And I wonder if there ought to, that the Dash 1 or in a Dash 2 ought to be clear that where there appears to be serious physical injury and appears so the officer doesn't have to determine that there was serious physical injury, they just believe or it appears there is. Because as you know from, well, you may or may not know, when we deal with criminal cases, it is not uncommon that what appears on the street, so to speak, is very different once you, not to be graphic, but wipe away the blood, you cast an arm, and suddenly what you thought was going to be a very serious injury ends up not. They're treated and released. So I think to get away from that, so the officer, it appears to be serious physical injury, appears to have contributed, I think that would be two things that would be important to have in here, even if they're included in a single statement on the citation.
Thank you for the comments. Questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 415? Not seeing anyone come forward. We'll close that public hearing. We'll open up our last scheduled public hearing for today, Senate Bill 424.
And Thank you, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. Senate Bill 424 pertains to the offense of failure to stop and or remain stopped for a pedestrian who is proceeding in accordance with a traffic control device or is crossing the roadway in a crosswalk. Specifically, Senate Bill 424 modifies the definition of crossing the roadway by making explicit that this term is meant to incorporate any part or extension of the pedestrian, including but not limited to any part of the pedestrian's body, wheelchair, cane, crutch, bicycle, or leashed animal. Though I understand that the last provision may be modified by amendment. This offense is presently a Class B traffic violation. The same definition would apply to the offense of a failure to stop and remain stopped for a person who is blind, also a Class C traffic violation.
All right, thank you. Jonathan, Class Ray, and Jeffrey Mandel, will you all please come forward?
Chair Prezonsky and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Manton, and I'm now testifying on behalf of the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition, on behalf of Senate Bill 424, in support of this legislation to try to clarify what it means when a pedestrian is actually crossing into the crosswalk. And looking at the current law, actually tends to encourage an aggressive pedestrian to assert their right-of-way by actually crossing into the crosswalk. And that provision is found in ORS 811.028, and it is Section 1, sub A. And so the reason for this legislation is to try to just clarify what it means when you're actually crossing into the crosswalk. And the impact of what this bill would do is to state that you start asserting your right-of-way once you put your a part of your body into the crosswalk, as well as having the intent to go ahead and cross. And that way a pedestrian, especially folks who are disabled, would be able to assert their right-of-way without having to actually launch all the way into the crosswalk be encouraging. The current law, in effect, encourages folks to be aggressive in that way. And so we think this will reduce conflict and clarify the law and increase public safety. And I'd be happy to answer any questions once we're done.
Great. Thank you. Ray?
Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. My name is Ray Thomas. I'm an attorney and a member of the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition Legislative Committee. Thank you for having me here today. I've provided you with a statutory analysis, which is part of the materials that are being passed out to you, about the genesis of the current Oregon law about crosswalks, which is contained in ORS 811.028, which is an excellent law. However, what we have is a situation where pedestrians, drivers, and law enforcement are not clear on what it takes where there is no walk, don't walk, because of course it's very easy where there's a walk, don't walk. You know that you're supposed to start walking when it's a walk, and you're not supposed to start when it's a don't walk. But in those intersections that don't have a signal telling us exactly what to do, where it's a marked or an unmarked crosswalk, it's not clear what does the pedestrian have to do to exercise the right-of-way, which they have in the crosswalk. And what this law does is to make it clear by saying that they have to move onto the roadway. What that means is that they have to be on the roadway. And you'll see that the dash one and the basic measure provides a description of how that might be for somebody who, for example, is in a wheelchair or has a cane or is rolling a bicycle or a shopping cart with them. And what it means is that it takes away the confusion for the pedestrian and for the approaching motorist as to when it is that that pedestrian is crossing in the crosswalk. And it doesn't have to be when the pedestrian is out in front of the car in a position of grave danger. It's when that pedestrian takes a foot or a cane tip off of the curb and places it onto the roadway. That's the signal. And for a law enforcement officer who's trying to enforce a safe neighborhood for kids to walk to school or for around a hospital people to cross or in front of the state capitol building to cross the street to get into the capitol, when the police officer sees that somebody takes a foot off
off of the curb and puts it into that crosswalk, what that means is it's time for the approaching cars to stop. This doesn't change the fundamental fact that outside of a crosswalk, cars have the right-of-way. It's only in a crosswalk that the pedestrians have the right-of-way. And this is completely unchanged by this. What it does is it provides a clear way so that people trying to use the crosswalks or enforce the laws for people who are trying to use the crosswalks will be able to see when it is that that crosswalk is something that's occupied by a pedestrian who's then having the right-of-way to cross safely. Thank you.
Thank you. And Jeffrey.
Yeah, hi. Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Mandel. I live in Portland, 224 Northeast 29th. I'm just here on my own behalf, not representing anybody. I have a written testimony that I'll try not to read, and it includes a bit of a personal story and a bit about why I support Senate Bill 424-1. In 2008, my wife was struck by a motor vehicle while she crossed the street on her way to work after getting off the bus. While she was in the crosswalk in an area of clear visibility and struck essentially in the center of the roadway on the driver's side of the car, the driver did not seem to notice her until the collision occurred. And under questioning, we asked the driver what she was looking at. She was looking at the tunnel, which was further up the road. And I think that while she her injuries were serious and she's recovering well, some of the issues that she faced in crossing that intersection in the crosswalk have to do with drivers noticing that a pedestrian has established the right-of-way and now has the right-of-way in the roadway. I believe that these amendments will help make it more clear and raise the profile of pedestrians crossing and the importance of the pedestrians' actions as they establish their intention to cross the roadway. I think it will also help make it clearer for law enforcement to recognize that a pedestrian has already established the right-of-way. hopefully that will make crossings in general safer for kids and adults and anybody who needs to cross the street. I'm hoping that there will be some increased effort at education for drivers to recognize that a pedestrian has established the right-of-way and that the driver is now required to respond. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you. I have a question for Ray. Ray, thanks for your work in this area, and I know you're probably one of our state's experts on these types of laws. A couple of questions for you. One is, I'm struggling with enforcement for this because we passed what I thought was a good law last session, which is banning use of cell phones while driving, and as a cyclist, that's one of the things that I still see pretty rampant is drivers on their phone, and was almost hit last week by somebody who went right through stop sign while they were on their phone. Can you talk a little bit about education for law enforcement and drivers on this? Because one of the things that I notice a lot, I have family in California, and I know in California they have very strict crosswalk laws. And I notice the drivers' behavior is very different from drivers in Oregon. And the minute anybody is right there, and I don't know what it is in California, if you have to be, if the language is similar, and I'm assuming you've looked at other states, but can you talk a little bit about that? And, you know, I don't expect the BTA and you as an individual to be there as the sole educator, but I think part of our challenge here in Oregon is also educating police enforcement and drivers about any changes that will be made.
Well, Chair Brzezinski and Senator Dingfelder, members of the committee, the way to, in this fiscal atmosphere, create better enforcement is to create more confident enforcement by law enforcement officers such that they feel confident that they know where the line is so that when they see something, they feel that they can cite and that that citation will be held up in court when that traffic offender appears. And that's why with this measure and with the what has come to be known as the VRU measure that we testified about earlier today, what we're trying to do is to build a higher level of confidence by law enforcement in working with these laws on behalf of people on the street. And in our law, in Oregon, we have good laws, we have a good traffic code, but sometimes what we can do is, without a fiscal, we can take a law passed like this one, if it's passed, and use it as an opportunity to educate in the schools, in the courts, on the streets, and the police officers will take it and work with it so that what we can do is to use the laws to raise consciousness. It's not a panacea for some of the things that are just maddening, such as people using cell phones when they should be paying attention to their driving. This isn't going to revolutionize anything, but it is an important step in a right and necessary direction, because what we in our communities will do is take a law like this one and distribute it to the schools, to the police, to the safety organizations, so that they can make it part of their safety message. And that's one of the things that we hope to be able to do without having the type of money that some types of massive overhauls require in this particular time.
Thank you.
Senator Wissett. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the council, please. Section 1 of this bill, sub 1, talks about crosswalks, and section 2, sub 2, it talks about bike lanes, and sub 3, it said limitations. Sub 4, the new language, doesn't mention the word crosswalk. It says the purpose of this section, a pedestrian is crossing the highway when any part of the extension of the pedestrian moves onto the roadway with intent to proceed. It doesn't mention crosswalks. Does that mean it would apply to any road anywhere in Oregon?
Chair Brzozinski, Senator Whitsitt, my reading is that this is a list of the various locations in which a pedestrian may establish right-of-way. There was testimony just aimed at crosswalk, but this is more expansive than that by my read. Again, in any of the following locations, in the lane in which the driver's vehicle is traveling, adjacent, the one in which they're going, the one adjacent to that. So I believe that this section does constitute a list of locations where this definition would apply. Now, that's not any roadway anywhere. You need one of these conditions precedent for the definition to kick in. Basically, I think, for example, in sub B, in the lane in which the driver's vehicle is traveling, would be an area in which this definition would suddenly sort of kick in and take place. So it is broader than crosswalk, but it is not every road everywhere at all times.
Well, I've been reading it in the construction of it. I don't see where it says or and. It says, sounds to me like each of those four subs stand alone.
Okay.
Chair Brzozinski, Senator Ray.
Hang on for a second, Council.
Well, if you'd like to answer.
Go ahead.
Far be it from me to want to disagree with committee counsel. However, I believe that if you take a look at the text of ORS 811.028, you'll see that there are two ways that the law applies. The first is when a person is crossing in accord with a traffic control device, and that's paragraph 1A. And it talks about what the requirements are for that. The alternative is when somebody is crossing on the roadway in a crosswalk. So this does not expand, at least as far as I can tell from statutory interpretation, the applicability of this concept beyond crosswalks.
I'd like to respond to that. Chair Brzozinski, I'll respectfully dissent from that reading. The reason I do that is because when I refer to Section 4, it makes reference to a definition applicable to the section, and that section is Section 1 ORS 811028, which outlines several different bases by which a pedestrian can establish right-of-way. Now, I suppose where I differ in my interpretation is at line 27, which is the start of subsection 4, which expands the breadth of the applicability of this definition. It says, for the purposes of this section, a pedestrian is crossing the roadway when any part or extension of the pedestrian, et cetera. And it doesn't mimic the language that's used in subsection 1A at line 7. And 8 above, where it says proceeding in accordance with a traffic control device or crossing the roadway in a crosswalk. If I saw the insertion of the in a crosswalk language, I would then assume that that definition was meant only to refer to the portion of the section having to do with a crosswalk. In the absence of that, when it says for the purposes of this section and then makes reference to a roadway, I can only assume it incorporates every subsection within the larger section.
May I respond?
No, we're not going to do a cross-counterpoint. I think we've got a issue that we need to look at. I expect that we will, in fact, look at that and making sure it's clear. I think the only question I would have for Jonathan or for Ray, since y'all were the ones that have worked on the drafting, it's my understanding that you're looking to basically enhance the area that is currently where a citizen would be crossing the roadway, which would be either in a marked or unmarked crosswalk, not in the middle of the street. Is that correct?
That's Chair Przanski, members of the committee, that is correct. That's correct.
All right.
Mr. Chair, what is an unmarked crosswalk?
It's at the area of the intersection. It may not be physically marked, but it is assumed at the corners.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just want to ask if any of the proponents are going to address the Dash 1 leashed animal amendment.
Senator Bonamici and Chair Przanski, yes, I can do that really quickly if you like. And I know there's some people behind me that would like to testify too. But what the Dash 1 did was to remove the language relating to a dog and a leash from the, when we're talking about just in these crosswalk situations. And the intent of that was because there was concern raised about the kind of leashes that are long, you know, that can have the string pull out. And you might have a dog enter the crosswalk with the owner, maybe not necessarily that close, and there was concern that that would create problems for what we're trying to accomplish. So we took out that language in the Dash 1. However, you'll notice that the dog is remaining under the section that deals with blind folks crossing, and that's for if there's a blind individual with a guard dog, it's a different scenario than a dog on a leash, and that's what we're accomplishing with that amendment.
All right, any other questions for this panel?
For the record, Mr. Chair, my dog often goes into streets that I don't intend to cross.
Heel. All right, thank you all very much.
I hope you don't have one of those long leashes.
And Jeff, thank you for coming forward. All right, I have Stefan Ralph and Maureen Zigbigny. I got that right this time.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Steph Routh. I'm director of the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to improving walking conditions and making the walking conditions safe, convenient, and attractive for everyone. I agree with, obviously, everything that was said before, so I won't belabor, but do believe that the Crosswalk Safety Bill 424-1 would give enforcement agencies and others a tool to better educate road users about crosswalk law. And just to your point, Senator Dingfelder, we do believe that education is one of the primary reasons that we are supporting this law. Last week, I helped facilitate a training of enforcement agencies, officers, through ODOT's Pedestrian Safety Enforcement Grant, which is a mini grant program that that promotes crosswalk safety enforcement actions throughout the state. They've had, just in 2010, 89 such actions that have been funded through that program with over 2,000 citations and more warnings. And education is really the basis for that program. We are closely involved in that, and we actually discuss crosswalk law with those enforcement agencies and discuss afterwards this bill, 424-1, with generally supportive comments. Those comments mimic
I believe the what you should have from written testimony from Captain Todd Wyatt of Portland Police Bureau's Traffic Division. And the other one, the other main reason is that crosswalk safety bill would also provide older adults, people with disabilities, and parents walking with children the ability to activate their right to cross from a position of safety. And I believe the written testimony from Kate Welch, who is a co-owner of pharmacy, Nehalem Bay Pharmacy in Wheeler, speaks more eloquently to that point than I could. But thank you very much for this opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you.
Okay, Chairman Prasansky and members of the committee, I'm Maureen Savigny from Klamath Falls and continuing to represent the Oregon Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee in speaking with you this morning. As I mentioned in my prior testimony on the Senate Bill 415-1, our committee did meet yesterday and we also voted unanimously to endorse this current bill, the Senate Bill 424, to enhance the safety of a variety of pedestrians in crosswalk situations. And we noted that we find many people who also have this hesitancy about when to proceed, particularly people who have mobility impairments. I can speak personally from Klamath Falls, where we have many of these unmarked crosswalks, and pedestrians do have right-of-way. We have an increasing number of retirees in our community, and I see them at bus stops where they need to cross the street and hesitate, when can I begin to enter? They have canes, they have walkers, some are in wheelchairs. And just to reduce the uncertainty and let it be known that, okay, you have now indicated your interest in crossing, it is now the motorist's responsibility to stop, I think we'll just make life simpler for all of the road users. And this is a view that is shared with our OBPAC committee. So I would just like to bring that forward for your consideration this morning. And thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for our panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward today. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 424? Not seeing anyone coming forward, I'm going to go ahead and close that public hearing. And what we're going to do is just do a reminder, if those who were not here earlier today, the work session on Senate Bill 77 will be carried over until tomorrow, and it should be ready to go with everything that we need to move that forward. The last two work session bills, Senate Bill 495 and 635, are quasi being carried over, actually are going to be reposted for next Tuesday, which is, I believe, April 5th. And with that, that should conclude our work. I do believe on that same day we should have Senate Bill 878 reposted, which is another bill dealing with DPSST, and we'll confirm that as well. Is there anything else we need to cover?
No, Chair.
All right, and so tomorrow's Wednesday. We will be here at 8:30 to start our morning session. Thank you, and we're adjourned.